Einstein? He has big ears. In the bathroom, he found Einstein standing on the counter, drinking out a sinkful of cold water that Nora had drawn for him. You know, Furface, for most dogs, the toilet is a perfectly adequate source of drinking water. Einstein sneezed at him, jumped down from the counter, and padded out of the bathroom. Travis had no means of shaving, but he decided a day's growth of beard would give him the look he needed for the work he would have to do this evening in the Tenderloin District. They left the motel and ate at the first McDonald's they could find. After lunch, they drove to a local branch of the Santa Barbara Bank where Travis had his checking account. They used his computer banking card, his MasterCard, and two of his Visa cards to make cash withdrawals totaling $1,400. Next, they went to an American Express office, and using one of Travis's checks and his gold card, they acquired the maximum allowable $500 in cash and $4,500 in traveler's checks. Combined with the $2,100 in cash and traveler's checks left over from their honeymoon, they had $8,500 in liquid assets. During the rest of the afternoon and early evening, they went shopping. With credit cards, they bought a complete set of luggage and purchased enough clothes to fill the bags. They got toiletries for both of them and an electric razor for Travis. Travis also bought a Scrabble game, and Nora said, "You don't really feel in the mood for games, do you?" "No," he replied cryptically, enjoying her puzzlement. "I'll explain later." Half an hour before sunset, with their purchases packed tightly in the spacious trunk of the Mercedes, Travis drove into the heart of San Francisco's Tenderloin, which was the area of the city that lay below O'Farrell Street, wedged between Market Street and Van Ness Avenue. It was a district of sleazy bars, featuring topless dancers, go-go joints where the girls wore nothing at all, rap parlors where men paid by the minute to sit with nude young women and talk about sex, and where more than talk was usually accomplished. This degeneracy was a shocking revelation to Nora, who had begun to think of herself as experienced and sophisticated. She was not prepared for the cesspool of the Tenderloin. She gaped at the gaudy neon signs that advertised peep shows, female mud wrestling, female impersonators, gay baths, and massage parlors. The meaning of some of the billboard come-ons at the worst bars baffled her, and she said, "What do they mean when the marquee says, 'Get a wink at the pink'?" Looking for a parking place, Travis said, "It means their girls dance entirely nude, and that during the dance they spread their labia to show themselves more completely."
"No!"
"Yes. My God, I don't believe it. I mean, I do believe it, but I don't believe it." "What's it mean, extreme close-up?" "The girls dance right at the customers' tables. The law doesn't allow touching, but the girls dance close, swinging their bare breasts in the customers' faces. You can insert one, maybe two, but not three sheets of paper between the nipples and the men's lips." In the back seat, Einstein snorted, as if with disgust.
"I agree, fella," Travis told him.
They passed a cancerous-looking place with flashing red and yellow bulbs and rippling bands of blue and purple neon, where the sign promised live sex show. Appalled, Nora said, "My God, are there other shows where they have sex with the dead?" Travis laughed so hard he almost back-ended a carload of gawking college boys. "No, no, no. Even the Tenderloin has some limits. They mean live as opposed to on film. You can see plenty of sex on film, theaters that show only pornography, but that place promises live sex on stage. I don't know if they deliver on the promise."
"And I don't care to find out," Nora said,
sounding as if she were Dorothy from Kansas and had just wandered into an unspeakable new neighborhood of Oz.
"What are we doing here?"
"This is the place you come to when you're trying to find things they don't sell on Nob Hill, like young boys, or really large amounts of dope, or phony driver's licenses and other counterfeit ID."
"Oh," she said. "Oh, yes, I see. This area is controlled by the underworld, by people like the Corleones and the Godfather."
"I'm sure the mob owns more of these places than not," he said, as he maneuvered the Mercedes into a parking space at the curb. "But don't ever make the mistake of thinking the real mob is a bunch of honorable cuties like the Corleones." Einstein was agreeable to remaining with the Mercedes.
"Tell you what, Furface, if we're real lucky," Travis joked, "we'll get you a new identity, too. We'll make you into a poodle."
Nora was surprised to discover that,
as twilight settled over the city. The breeze off the bay was chilly enough for them to need the nylon quilt-lined jackets they had bought earlier in the day. "Even in summer, nights can be cool here," he said. "Soon the fog rolls in. The stored-up heat of the day pulls it off the water." He would have worn his jacket even if the evening air had been mild, for he was carrying his loaded revolver under his belt and needed the jacket to conceal it. "Is there really a chance you'll need the gun?" she asked, as they walked away from the car.
"Not likely. I'm carrying it mainly for ID.
"Huh?"
"You'll see."
She looked back at the car, where Einstein was staring out the rear window, looking forlorn. She felt bad leaving him there. But she was quite certain that even if these establishments would admit dogs, such places were not good for Einstein's moral welfare. Travis seemed interested solely in those bars whose signs were either in both English and Spanish, or in Spanish only. Some places were downright shabby, and did not conceal the peeling paint and the moldy carpeting, while others used mirrors and glitzy lighting to try to hide their true roach-hole nature. A few were actually clean and expensively decorated. In each, Travis spoke in Spanish with the bartender, sometimes with musicians if there were any and if they were on a break, and a few times he distributed folded $20 bills. Since she spoke no Spanish, Nora did not know what he was asking about or why he was paying these people. On the street, searching for another sleazy lounge, he explained that the biggest illegal migration was Mexican, Salvadoran, Nicaraguan, desperate people escaping economic chaos and political repression. Therefore, more Spanish-speaking illegals were in the market for phony papers than were Vietnamese, Chinese, or those in all other language groups put together. So the quickest way to get a lead on a supplier of phony papers through the Latino underworld.
"Have you got a lead?"
"Not yet. Just bits and pieces. And probably 99% of what I've paid for is nonsense, lies. But don't worry. We'll find what we need. That's why the Tenderloin doesn't go out of business. People who come here always find what they need."
The people who came here surprised Nora. In the streets, in the topless bars, all kinds could be found. Asians, Latinos, whites, blacks, and even Indians mingled in an alcoholic haze. So it seemed as if racial harmony was a beneficial side effect of the pursuit of sin. Guys swaggered around in leather jackets and jeans, guys who looked like hoods, which she expected. But there were also men in business suits, clean-cut college kids, others dressed like cowboys, and wholesome surfer types who looked as if they had stepped out of an old Annette Funicello movie. Bums sat on the pavement or stood on corners, grizzled old winos in reeking clothes, and even some of the business suit types had a weird glint in their eyes that made you want to run from them. But it seemed as if most of the people here were those who would pass for ordinary upstanding citizens in any decent neighborhood. Nora was amazed. Not many women were on the streets or in the company of the men in these bars. No, correct that. There were women to be seen. But they looked more lascivious than the nude dancers, and only a few of them seemed not to be for sale. At a topless bar called Hot Tips, which had signs in both Spanish and English, the recorded rock music was so loud Nora got a headache. Six beautiful girls with exquisite bodies, wearing only spike heels and sequin bikini panties, were dancing at the tables, wriggling, writhing, swinging their breasts in the sweaty faces of men who were either mesmerized or hooting and clapping. Other topless girls, equally pretty, were waitressing. While Travis spoke in Spanish with the bartender, Nora noticed some of the customers looking at her appraisingly. They gave her the creeps. She kept one hand on Travis's arm. She couldn't have been torn away from him with a crowbar. The stink of stale beer and whiskey, body odor, the layered scents of various cheap perfumes and cigarette smoke made the air as heavy as that in a steam bath, though less healthful. Nora clenched her teeth and thought, "I will not be sick and make a fool of myself. I simply will not." After a couple of minutes of rapid conversation, Travis passed a pair of 20s to the bartender and was directed to the back of the lounge, where a guy as big as Arnold Schwarzenegger was sitting on a chair beside a doorway that was covered by a densely beaded curtain. He was wearing black leather pants and a white t-shirt. His arms seemed as large as tree trunks. His face looked as if it had been cast in cement,
and he had gray eyes almost as transparent as glass. Travis spoke with him in Spanish and passed him 220s. The music faded from a thunderous din to a mere roar. A woman speaking into a microphone said, "All right, boys, if you like what you see, then show it. Start stuffing those pussies." Nora twitched in shock, but as the music rose again, she saw what was meant by the crude announcement. The customers were expected to slip folded $5 and $10 bills into the dancers' panties. The hulk in black leather pants got off his chair and led them through the beaded curtain into a room 10 feet wide and 18 or 20 feet long, where 6 more young women in spike heels and bikini panties were getting ready to take over from the dancers already on the floor. They were checking their makeup in mirrors, applying lipstick, or just chatting with each other. They were all, she saw, as good-looking as the girls out front. Some of them had hard faces, pretty but hard, though others were as fresh-faced as schoolteachers. All were the kind of women that men probably had in mind when they talked about girls who were stacked. The hulk led Travis, and Travis led Nora, holding her hand, through that dressing room toward the door at the other end. As they went, one of the topless dancers, a striking blonde, put a hand on Nora's shoulder and walked beside her.
"Are you new, honey?" "Me? No. Oh, no. I don't work here."
The blonde, who was so well endowed that Nora felt like a boy, said,
"You got the equipment, honey?"
"Oh, no," was all Nora could say.
"You like my equipment?"
the blonde asked.
"Oh, well, you're very pretty," Nora said.
To the blonde, Travis said, "Give it up, sister. The lady doesn't swing that way." The blonde smiled sweetly.
"If she tries it, she might like it."
They went through a door, out of the dressing room and into a narrow, shabby, poorly lit hallway, before Nora realized she had been propositioned by a woman. She did not know whether to laugh or gag. Probably both. The hulk took them to an office at the back of the building and left them, saying, "Mr. Van Dyne will be with you in a minute." The office had gray walls, gray metal chairs, filing cabinets, and a gray metal desk that was battered and scarred. No pictures or calendars hung on the bare walls. No pens or notepads or reports were on the desk. The place looked as if it was seldom used. Nora and Travis sat on the 2 metal chairs in front of the desk. The music from the bar was still audible, but no longer deafening. When she caught her breath, Nora said, "Where do they all come from?"
"Who?"
"All those pretty girls with their perfect boobs and tight little bottoms and long legs, and all of them willing to do that. Where do so many of them come from?" "There's a breeding farm outside of Modesto," Travis said. She gaped at him. He laughed and said, "I'm sorry. I keep forgetting how innocent you are, Mrs. Cornell." He kissed her cheek. His stubble scratched a little, but it was nice. In spite of wearing yesterday's clothes and not having shaved, he seemed as clean as a well-scrubbed baby compared to the gauntlet they had run in order to reach this office. He said, "I should answer you straight because you don't know when I'm joking." She blinked.
"Then there isn't a breeding farm outside Modesto?"
"No. There's all kinds of girls who do it. Girls who hope to break into showbiz, go to L.A. to be movie stars but can't make it. So they drift into places like this in L.A., or they come north to San Francisco, or they go to Vegas. Most are decent enough kids. They see this as temporary. Very good money can be made fast. It's a way to build up a stake before taking another crack at Hollywood. Then there's some, the self-haters, who do it to humiliate themselves. Others are in rebellion from their parents, from their first husbands, from the whole damn world. And some are hookers."
"The hookers meet Johns here?" she asked.
"Maybe, maybe not. Some probably dance to have an explicable source of income when the IRS knocks on their doors. They report their earnings as dancers, which gives them a better chance of concealing what they make from turning tricks."
"It's sad," she said.
"Yeah. In some cases, in a lot of cases, it's damn sad." Fascinated, she said, "Will we get false ideas from this Van Dyne?"
"I believe so."
She regarded him solemnly.
"You really do know your way around, don't you?
Does it bother you that I know places like this?"
She thought a moment. Then, "No. In fact, if a woman's going to take a husband, I suppose he ought to be a man who knows what to do in any situation. It gives me a lot of confidence."
"In me?"
"In you, yes. and confidence that we're going to get through this all right, that we're going to save Einstein and ourselves. Confidence is good, but in Delta Force, one of the first things you learn is that being overly confident can get you killed. The door opened, and the Hulk returned with a round-faced man in a gray suit, blue shirt, and black tie.
Van Dyne, the newcomer said, but he did not offer to shake hands.
He went around the desk and sat in a springback chair. He had thinning blonde hair and baby-smooth cheeks. He looked like a stockbroker in a television commercial, efficient, smart, as well-meaning as he was well-groomed.
I wanted to talk to you because I want to know who's spreading these falsehoods about me.
Travis said, we need new ID, driver's licenses, social security cards, the whole works. First rate with full backup, not junk.
That's what I'm talking about, Van Dyne said.
He raised his eyebrows quizzically.
Where on earth did you get the idea that I'm in that sort of business? I'm afraid you've been misinformed.
We need first rate paper with full backup, Travis repeated. Van Dyne stared at him, at Nora.
Let me see your wallet, and your purse, miss.
Putting his wallet on the desk, Travis told Nora, it's okay. Reluctantly, she put her purse beside the wallet.
Please stand, and let Caesar search you, Van Dyne said.
Travis stood, and motioned for Nora to get up as well. Caesar, the cement-faced hulk, searched Travis with embarrassing thoroughness, found the .357 Magnum, put it on the desk. He was even more thorough with Nora, unbuttoning her blouse and boldly feeling the cups of her bra for a miniature microphone, battery, and recorder. She blushed and would not have permitted these intimacies if Travis had not explained to her what Caesar was looking for. Besides, Caesar remained expressionless throughout, as if he were a machine without the potential for erotic response. When Caesar was finished with them, they sat down while Van Dyne went through Travis's wallet and then through Nora's purse. She was afraid he was going to take their money without giving them anything in return. But he appeared to be interested in only their ID and the butcher's knife that Nora still carried. To Travis, Van Dyne said,
Okay, if you were a cop, you wouldn't be allowed to carry a Magnum.
He swung out the cylinder and looked at the ammunition.
Loaded with Magnums. The ACLU would have your ass.
He smiled at Nora.
No policewoman carries a butcher's knife.
Suddenly she understood what Travis meant when he'd said he was carrying the revolver not for protection, but for its value as ID. Van Dyne and Travis haggled a bit, finally setting on $6,500 as the price for two sets of ID with full backup. Their belongings, including the butcher's knife and revolver, were returned to them. From the gray office, they followed Van Dyne into the narrow hall, where he dismissed Caesar, then to a set of dimly lit concrete stairs leading to a basement beneath hot tips, where the rock music was further filtered by the intervening concrete floor. Nora was not sure what she expected to find in the basement. Maybe men who all looked like Edward G. Robinson, and wore green eye shades on elastic bands, and labored over antique printing presses, producing not just false identification papers, but stacks of phony currency. What she found, instead, surprised her. The steps ended in a stone-walled storage room about 40 by 30 feet. Bar supplies were stacked to shoulder height. They walked along a narrow aisle formed by cartons of whiskey, beer, and cocktail napkins, to a steel fire door in the rear wall. Van Dyne pushed a button in the doorframe, and a closed-circuit security camera made a purring sound as it panned them. The door was open from inside, and they went through into a smaller room with subdued lighting, where two young bearded guys were working at two of seven computers lined up on work tables along one wall. The first guy was wearing soft Rockport shoes, safari pants, a web belt, and a cotton safari shirt. The other wore Reeboks, jeans, and a sweatshirt that featured the Three Stooges. They looked almost like twins, and both resembled young versions of Steven Spielberg. They were so intensely involved with their computer work that they did not look up at Nora and Travis and Van Dyne. But they were having fun, too, talking exuberantly to themselves, to their machines, and to each other in high-tech language that made no sense whatsoever to Nora. A woman in her early 20s was also at work in the room. She had short blonde hair and oddly beautiful eyes, the color of pennies. While Van Dyne spoke with the two guys at the computers, the woman took Travis and Nora to the far end of the room, put them in front of a white screen, and photographed them for the phony driver's licenses. When the blonde disappeared into a dark room to develop the film, Travis and Nora rejoined Van Dyne at the computers, where the young men were working happily. Nora watched them accessing the supposedly secure computers of the California Department of Motor Vehicles and the Social Security Administration, as well as those of other federal, state, and local government agencies. "When I told Mr. Van Dyne that I wanted ID with full backup," Travis explained, "I meant the driver's licenses must be able to stand up to inspection if we're ever stopped by a highway patrolman who runs a check on them. The licenses we're getting are indistinguishable from the real thing. These guys are inserting our new names into the DMV's files, actually creating computer records of these licenses in the state's databanks." Van Dyne said, "The addresses are phony, of course, but when you settle down somewhere under your new names, you just apply to the DMV for a change of address like the law requires, and then you'll be perfectly legit. We're setting these up to expire in about a year, at which time you'll go into a DMV office, take the usual test, and get brand new licenses because your new names are in the files."
"What are our new names?" Nora wondered.
"You see," Van Dyne said, speaking with the quiet assurance and patience of a stockbroker explaining the market to a new investor, "we have to start with birth certificates. We keep computer files of infant deaths all over the western United States, going back at least 50 years. We've already searched those lists for the years each of you was born, trying to find babies who died with your hair and eye colors, and with your first names, too, just because it's easy for you not to have to change both first and last. We found a little girl, Nora Jean Ames, born October 12th of the year you were born, and who died 1 month later, right here in San Francisco. We have a laser printer with virtually an infinite choice of type styles and sizes, with which you've already produced a facsimile of the kind of birth certificate that was in use in San Francisco at that time. And it bears Nora Jean's name, Vital Statistics. We'll make 2 Xeroxes of it, and you'll receive both. Next, we tapped into the Social Security files and appropriated a number for Nora Jean Ames, who was never given one, and we also created a history of Social Security tax payments." He smiled. "You've already paid in enough quarters to qualify for a pension when you retire. Likewise, the IRS now has computer records that show you've worked as a waitress in 6 cities and that you faithfully paid your taxes every year." Travis said, "With a birth certificate and legitimate Social Security number, they were then able to get a driver's license that would have a real ID behind it."
"So I'm Nora Jean Ames? But if her birth certificate's on record, so is her death certificate. If someone wanted to check..."
Van Dyne shook his head. "In those days, both birth and death certificates were strictly paper documents, no computer files. And because it squanders more money than it spends wisely, the government has never had the funds to transfer records of the pre-computer era into electronic databanks. So if someone gets suspicious about you, they can't just search out the death records on computer and learn the truth in 2 minutes flat. They'd have to go to the courthouse, dig back through the coroner's files for that year, and find Nora Jean's death certificate. But that won't happen, because part of our service involves having Nora Jean's certificate removed from public records and destroyed, now that you've bought her identity."
"We're into TRW, the credit reporting agency," one of the twin Spielberg lookalikes said with obvious delight.
Nora saw data flickering across the green screens, but none of it had any meaning for her.
"They're creating solid credit histories for our new identities," Travis told her. "By the time we do settle down somewhere and put in a change of address with the DMV and TRW, our mailbox will be flooded with offers for credit cards, Visa, MasterCard, probably even American Express and Carte Blanche."
"Nora Jean Ames," she said numbly, trying to grasp how quickly and thoroughly her new life was being built. Because they could locate no infant who had died in the year of Travis's birth with his first name, he had to settle for being Samuel Spencer Hyatt, who had been born that January and had perished that March in Portland, Oregon. The death would be expunged from the public record, and Travis's new identity would stand up to fairly intense scrutiny. Strictly for fun, they said, the bearded young operators created a military record for Travis, crediting him 6 years in the Marines and awarding him a Purple Heart, plus a couple of citations for bravery during a peacekeeping mission turned violent in the Middle East. To their delight, he asked if they could also create a valid real estate broker's license under his new name, and within 25 minutes, they cracked into the right databanks and did the job.
"Cake and pie," one of the young men said. "Cake and pie," the other echoed.
Nora frowned, not understanding.
"Piece of cake,"
one of them explained. Easy as pie, the other said.
Cake and pie, Nora said, nodding.
The blonde with the copper penny eyes returned, carrying driver's licenses imprinted with Travis's and Nora's pictures.
You're both quite photogenic, she said.
2 hours and 20 minutes after meeting Van Dyne, they left Hot Tips with 2 manila envelopes containing a variety of documents supporting their new identities. Out on the street, Nora felt a little dizzy and held on to Travis's arm all the way back to the car. Fog had rolled through the city while they'd been in Hot Tips. The blinking lights and flashing, rippling neon of the Tenderloin were softened, yet curiously magnified by the mist. So it seemed as if every cubic centimeter of night air was awash with strange lights, with an aurora borealis brought down to ground level. Those sleazy streets had a certain mystery and cheap allure after dark in the fog, but not if you'd seen them in daylight first and remembered what you'd seen. In the Mercedes, Einstein was waiting patiently.
Couldn't arrange to have you turned into a poodle after all,
Nora told him as she buckled her seatbelt.
But we sure did ourselves upright.
Einstein, say hello to Sam Hyatt and Nora Ames. The retriever put his head on the front seat, looked at her, looked at Travis, and snorted once as if to say they could not fool him, that he knew who they were. To Travis, Nora said,
Your anti-terrorist training. Is that where you learned about places like Hot Tips? People like Van Dyne? Is that where terrorists get new ID once they slip into the country?
Yeah, some go to people like Van Dyne, though not usually. The Soviets supply papers for most terrorists. Van Dyne services mostly ordinary illegal immigrants, though not the poor ones, and criminal types looking to dodge arrest warrants. As he started the car, she said,
But if you could find Van Dyne, maybe the people looking for us can find him.
Maybe. It'll take them a while, but maybe they can.
Then they'll find out all about our new identities.
No, Travis said. He turned on the defroster and the windshield wipers to clear the condensation off the outside of the glass. Van Dyne wouldn't keep records. He doesn't want to be caught with proof of what he does. If the authorities ever tumble to him and go in there with search warrants, they won't find anything in Van Dyne's computers except the accounting and purchasing records for Hot Tips. As they drove through the city, heading for the Golden Gate Bridge, Nora stared in fascination at the people in the streets and in other cars, not just in the Tenderloin, but in every neighborhood through which they passed. She wondered how many of them were living under the names and identities with which they'd been born, and how many were changelings like her and Travis.
In less than 3 hours, we've been totally remade, she said.
Some world we live in, huh? More than anything else, that's what high technology means. Maximum fluidity. The whole world is becoming ever more fluid, malleable. Most financial transactions are now handled with electronic money that flashes from New York to L.A., or around the world, in seconds. Money crosses borders in a blink. It no longer has to be smuggled out past the guards. Most records are kept in the form of electrical charges that only computers read. So everything's fluid. Identities are fluid. The past is fluid.
Nora said, Even the genetic structure of a species is fluid these days.
Einstein woofed agreement.
Nora said, Scary, isn't it?
A little, Travis said, as they approached the light-bedecked southern entrance to the fog-mantled Golden Gate Bridge, which was all but invisible in the mist. But maximum fluidity is basically a good thing. Social and financial fluidity guarantee freedom. I believe, and I hope, that we're heading toward an age when the role of government will inevitably dwindle. When there'll be no way to regulate and control people as thoroughly as was possible in the past. Totalitarian governments won't be able to stay in power.
How so?
Well, how can a dictatorship control its citizens in a high-tech society of maximum fluidity? The only way is to refuse to allow high-tech to intrude, seal the borders, and live entirely in an earlier age. But that'd be national suicide for any country that tried it. They couldn't compete. In a few decades, they'd be modern aborigines, primitive by the standards of the civilized high-tech world. Right now, for instance, the Soviets try to restrict computers to their defense industry, which can't last. They'll have to computerize their entire economy and teach their people to use computers. And then, how can they keep the screws tight when their citizens have been given the means to manipulate the system and foil its controls on them? At the entrance to the bridge, no northbound toll was collected. They drove on to the span, where the speed limit had been drastically reduced because of the weather. looking up at the ghostly skeleton of the bridge, which glistened with condensation and vanished in the fog, Nora said, "You seem to think the world will be paradise in a decade or two." "Not paradise," he said. "Easier, richer, safer, happier. But not a paradise. After all, there will still be all the problems of the human heart and all the potential sicknesses of the human mind. And the new world's bound to bring us some new dangers as well as blessings."
"Like the thing that killed your landlord," she said.
"Yes." In the back seat, Einstein growled. Part 12. That Thursday afternoon, August 26th, Vince Nasco drove to Johnny the Wire Santini's place in San Clemente to pick up the past week's report, which was when he learned of the murder of Ted Hockney in Santa Barbara the previous evening. The condition of the corpse, especially the missing eyes, linked it to the outsider. Johnny had also ascertained that the NSA had quietly assumed jurisdiction in the case, which convinced Vince it was related to the Bannadine fugitives. That evening, he got a newspaper, and over a dinner of seafood enchiladas and Dos Equis at a Mexican restaurant, he read about Hockney and about the man who had rented the house where the murder occurred, Travis Cornell. The press was reporting that Cornell, a former real estate broker who had once been a member of Delta Force, kept a panther in the house and that the cat had killed Hockney. But Vince knew that the cat was bullshit, just a cover story. The cops said they wanted to talk to Cornell and to an unidentified woman seen with him, though they had not filed any charges against them. The story also had one line about Cornell's dog. "Cornell and the woman may be traveling with a golden retriever." "If I can find Cornell," Vince thought, "I'll find the dog." This was the first break he'd had, and it confirmed his feeling that owning the retriever was a part of his great destiny. To celebrate, he ordered more seafood enchiladas and beer. Part 13. Travis, Nora, and Einstein stayed Thursday night at a motel in Marin County, north of San Francisco. They got a six-pack of San Miguel at a convenience store and takeout chicken, biscuits, and coleslaw from a fast-food restaurant, and ate a late dinner in the room. Einstein enjoyed the chicken and showed considerable interest in the beer. Travis decided to pour half a bottle in the new yellow plastic dish they'd gotten the retriever during their shopping spree earlier in the day. "But no more than half a bottle, no matter how much you like it. I want you sober for some questions and answers." After dinner, the three of them sat on the king-sized bed, and Travis unwrapped the Scrabble game. He put the board upside down on the mattress, with the playing surface concealed, and Nora helped him sort all the lettered game tiles into 26 piles. Einstein watched with interest, and did not seem even slightly woozy from his half bottle of San Miguel. "Okay," Travis said. "I need more detailed answers than we've been able to get with yes and no questions. It occurred to me that this might work."
"Ingenious," Nora agreed.
To the dog, Travis said, "I ask you a question, and you indicate the letters that are needed to spell out the answer, one letter at a time, word by word. You got it?" Einstein blinked at Travis, looked at the stacks of lettered tiles, raised his eyes to Travis again, and grinned. Travis said, "All right. Do you know the name of the laboratory from which you escaped?" Einstein put his nose to the pile of bees. Nora plucked a tile off the stack and put it on the portion of the board that Travis had left clear. In less than a minute, the dog spelled Bannadine.
"Bannadine," Travis said thoughtfully. "Never heard of it.
Is that the entire name?" Einstein hesitated, then began to choose more letters until he had spelled out Bannadine Laboratories, Inc. On a pad of motel stationery, Travis made a note of the answer, then returned all the tiles to their individual stacks. "Where is Bannadine located?"
"Irvine."
"That makes sense," Travis said. "I found you in the woods north of Irvine." "All right. I found you on Tuesday, May 18th. When had you escaped from Bannadine?" Einstein stared at the tiles, whined, and made no choices. "In all the reading you've done," Travis said, "you've learned about months, weeks, days, and hours. You have a sense of time now." Looking at Nora, the dog whined again. She said, "He has a sense of time now, but he didn't have one when he escaped, so it's hard to remember how long he was on the run." Immediately, Einstein began to indicate letters.
That's right.
Do you know the names of any of the researchers at Banodyne?
Davis Weatherby.
Travis made a note of the name.
Any others?
Hesitating frequently to consider possible spellings, Einstein finally produced Lawton, Haynes, Al, Hudson, and a few more. After noting all of them on the motel stationery, Travis said,
These will be some of the people looking for you.
Yes, and Johnson.
Johnson?
Nora said.
Is he one of the scientists?
No. The retriever thought for a moment, studied the stack of letters, and finally continued.
Security.
He's head of security at Banodyne?
Travis asked.
No, bigger.
Probably a federal agent of some kind,
Travis told Nora as she returned the letters to their stacks.
To Einstein, Nora said, Do you know this Johnson's first name?
Einstein gazed at the letters and mewled, and Travis was about to tell him it was all right if he didn't know Johnson's first name, but then the dog attempted to spell it.
Lemuel.
There's no such name, Nora said, taking the letters away. Einstein tried again.
Lemuel.
Then again, Lemuel.
That's not a name either, Travis said.
A third time.
Lemuel.
Travis realized the dog was struggling to spell the name phonetically. He chose six-lettered tiles of his own.
Lemuel.
Lemuel Johnson, Nora said. Einstein leaned forward and nuzzled her neck. He was wiggling with pleasure at having gotten the name across to them. And the springs of the motel bed creaked. Then he stopped nuzzling Nora and spelled Dark Lemuel.
Dark,
Travis said. By dark you mean Johnson is evil?
No, dark.
Nora restacked the letters and said,
Dangerous?
Einstein snorted at her, then at Travis, as if to say they were sometimes unbearably thick-headed.
No, dark.
For a moment they sat in silence, thinking. And at last Travis said,
Black! You mean Lemuel Johnson is a black man?
Einstein chuffed softly, shook his head up and down, swept his tail back and forth on the bedspread. He indicated 19 letters, his longest answer. There's hope for you yet.
Nora laughed.
Travis said, Wise ass. But he was exhilarated, filled with a joy that he would have been hard-pressed to describe if he'd been required to put it into words. They had been communicating with the retriever for many weeks, but the Scrabble tiles provided a far greater dimension to their conversations than they had enjoyed previously. More than ever, Einstein seemed to be their own child. But there was also an intoxicating feeling of breaking through the barriers of normal human experience, a feeling of transcendence. Einstein was no ordinary mutt, of course, and his high intelligence was more human than canine, but he was a dog. More than anything else, a dog. And his intelligence was still qualitatively different from that of a man. So there was inevitably a strong sense of mystery and a great wonder in this interspecies dialogue. Staring at, There's hope for you yet, Travis thought a broader meaning could be read into the message, that it could be directed at all humankind. For the next half an hour, they continued questioning Einstein, and Travis recorded the dog's answers. In time, they discussed the yellow-eyed beast that had killed Ted Hockney.
What is the damn thing?
Nora asked.
The outsider,
Travis said.
The outsider?
What do you mean?
That's what they called it.
The people in the lab? Travis asked.
Why do they call it the outsider?
Because it does not belong. Nora said,
I don't understand.
Two successes, me and it. I am dog. It is nothing that can be named. Outsider.
Travis said, It's intelligent too?
Yes.
As intelligent as you?
Maybe.
Jesus,
Travis said, shaken. Einstein made an unhappy sound and put his head on Nora's knee, seeking the reassurance that petting could provide him.
Travis said, Why would they create a thing like that?
Einstein returned to the stacks of letters.
To kill for them.
A chill trickled down Travis's spine and seeped deep into him. Who did they want it to kill?
The enemy.
What enemy? Nora asked.
In war.
With understanding came revulsion bordering on nausea. Travis sagged back against the headboard. He remembered telling Nora that even a world without want and with universal freedom would fall short of paradise because of all the problems of the human heart and all the potential sicknesses of the human mind. To Einstein, he said, "So you're telling us that the outsider is a prototype of a genetically engineered soldier, sort of a very intelligent, deadly police dog designed for the battlefield?"
"It was made to kill. It wants to kill."
Reading the words as she laid out the tiles, Nora was appalled. "But this is crazy. How could such a thing ever be controlled? How could it be counted on not to turn against its masters?" Travis leaned forward from the headboard. To Einstein, he said, "Why is the outsider looking for you?"
"Hates me."
"Why does it hate you?"
"Don't know."
As Nora replaced the letters, Travis said, "Will it continue looking for you?"
"Yes, forever."
"But how does something like that move unseen?"
"At night."
"Nevertheless, like rats move unseen." Looking puzzled, Nora said, "But how does it track you?"
"Feels me."
"Feels you? What do you mean?" she asked. The retriever puzzled over that one for a long time, making several false starts on an answer, and finally said, "Can't explain." "Can you feel it, too?" Travis asked.
"Sometimes."
"Do you feel it now?"
"Yes, far away."
"Very far away," Travis agreed. "Hundreds of miles. Can it really feel you and track you from that far away?"
"Even farther."
"Is it tracking you now?"
"Coming."
The chill in Travis grew icier.
"When will it find you?"
"Don't know." The dog looked dejected, and he was shivering again. "Soon? Will it feel its way to you soon?"
"Maybe not soon."
Travis saw that Nora was pale. He put a hand on her knee and said, "We won't run from it the rest of our lives. Damned if we will. We'll find a place to settle down and wait. A place where we'll be able to prepare a defense, and where we'll have the privacy to deal with the outsider when it arrives." Shivering, Einstein indicated more letters with his nose, and Travis laid out the tiles.
"I should go."
"What do you mean?" Travis asked, replacing the tiles.
"I danger you."
Nora threw her arms around the retriever and hugged him. "Don't you even think such a thing? You're part of us. You're family, damn you. We're all family. We're all in this together, and we stick it out together because that's what families do." She stopped hugging the dog and took his head in both hands, met him nose to nose, peered deep into his eyes. "If I woke up some morning and found you'd left us, it'd break my heart." Tears shimmered in her eyes, a tremor in her voice. "Do you understand me, Furface? It would break my heart if you went off on your own." The dog pulled away from her and began to choose lettered tiles again.
"I would die."
"You would die if you left us?" Travis asked. The dog chose more letters, waited for them to study the words, then looked solemnly at each of them to be sure they understood what he meant.
"I would die of lonely."
Part 2. Guardian. Love alone is capable of uniting living beings in such a way as to complete and fulfill them, for it alone takes them and joins them by what is deepest in themselves. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. The Gospel according to St. John. Chapter 8. Part 1. On the Thursday that Nora drove to Dr. Weingold's office, Travis and Einstein went for a walk across the grassy hills and through the woods behind the house they had bought in the beautiful California coastal region called Big Sur. On the treeless hills, the autumn sun warmed the stones and cast scattered cloud shadows. The breeze off the Pacific drew a whisper from the dry golden grass. In the sun, the air was mild, neither hot nor cool. Travis was comfortable in jeans and a long-sleeved shirt. He carried a Mossberg shot-barreled pistol-grip pump-action 12-gauge shotgun. He always carried it on his walks. If he ever encountered someone who asked about it, he intended to tell them he was hunting rattlesnakes. Where the trees grew most vigorously, the bright morning seemed like late afternoon, and the air was cool enough to make Travis glad that his shirt was flannel. Massive pines, a few small groves of giant redwoods, and a variety of foothill hardwoods filtered the sun and left much of the forest floor in perpetual twilight. The undergrowth was dense in places. The vegetation included those low, impenetrable thickets of evergreen oaks sometimes called chaparral, plus lots of ferns that flourished because of the frequent fog and the constant humidity of the seacoast air. Einstein repeatedly sniffed out cougar's spoor and insisted on showing Travis the tracks of the big cats in the damp forest soil. Fortunately, he fully understood the danger of stalking a mountain lion and was able to repress his natural urge to prowl after them. The dog contented himself with merely observing local fauna. Timid deer could often be seen ascending or descending their trails. Raccoons were plentiful and fun to watch, although some were quite friendly. Einstein knew they could turn nasty if he accidentally frightened them. He chose to keep a respectful distance. On other walks, the retriever had been dismayed to discover the squirrels, which he could approach safely, were terrified of him. They froze with fear, stared wild-eyed, small hearts pounding visibly. "Why squirrels afraid?" he asked Travis one evening. "Instinct," Travis had explained. "You're a dog, and they know instinctively that dogs will attack and kill them." "Not me." "No, not you," Travis agreed, ruffling the dog's coat. "You wouldn't hurt them. But the squirrels don't know you're different, do they? To them, you look like a dog, and you smell like a dog. So you've got to be feared like a dog."
"I like squirrels."
"I know. Unfortunately, they're not smart enough to realize it." Consequently, Einstein kept his distance from the squirrels and tried hard not to terrify them, often sauntering past with his head turned the other way, as if unaware of them. This special day, their interest in squirrels and deer and birds and raccoons and unusual forest flora was minimal. Even views of the Pacific did not intrigue them. Today, unlike other days, they were walking only to pass the time and to keep their minds off Nora. Travis repeatedly looked at his watch, and he chose a circular route that would bring them back to the house at 1 o'clock, when Nora was expected to return. It was the 21st of October, 8 weeks after they'd acquired new identities in San Francisco. After considerable thought, they decided to come south, substantially reducing the distance that the outsider would have to travel in order to put its hands on Einstein. They would not be able to get on with their new lives until the beast found them, until they killed it. Therefore, they wanted to hasten rather than delay that confrontation. On the other hand, they did not want to risk returning too far south toward Santa Barbara, for the outsider might cover the distance between them faster than had traveled from Orange County to Santa Barbara last summer. They could not be certain that it would continue to make only 3 or 4 miles a day. If it moved faster this time, it might come upon them before they were ready for it. The Big Sur area, because of its sparse population, and because it was 190 air miles from Santa Barbara, seemed ideal. If the outsider got a fix on Einstein and tracked him down as slowly as before, the thing would not arrive for almost 5 months. If it doubled its speed somehow, swiftly crossing the open farmland and the wild hills between there and here, quickly skirting populated areas, it would still not reach them until the second week of November. That day was drawing near, but Travis was satisfied that he had made every preparation possible, and he almost welcomed the outsider's arrival. Thus far, however, Einstein said that he did not feel his adversary was dangerously close. Evidently, they still had plenty of time to test their patience before the showdown. By 12:50, they reached the end of their circular route through the hills and canyons, returning to the yard behind their new house. It was a two-story structure with bleached wood walls, a cedar-shingled roof, and massive stone chimneys on both the north and south sides. It boasted front and rear porches on the east and west, and either vantage point offered a view of wooded slopes. Because no snow ever fell here, the roof was only gently pitched, making it possible to walk all over it, and that was where Travis made one of his first defensive modifications to the house. He looked up now, as he came out of the trees, and saw the herringbone pattern of 2x4s that he had fixed across the roof. They would make it safer and easier to move quickly across those sloped surfaces. If the outsider crept up on the house at night, it would not be able to enter by the downstairs windows, because at sundown, those were barricaded with interior locking shutters that Travis had installed himself, and that would foil any would-be intruder except, perhaps, a manically determined man with an axe. The outsider would then most likely climb the porch post onto the front or rear porch roof to have a look at the second floor windows, which it would find also protected by interior shutters. Meanwhile, warned of the enemy's approach by an infrared alarm system that he had installed around the house 3 weeks ago, Travis would go onto the roof by way of an attic trap door. Up there, making use of the 2x4 handholds, he would be able to creep to the edge of the main roof, look down on the porch roof, or on any portion of the surrounding yard, and open fire on the outsider from a position where it could not reach him. 20 yards behind and east of the house was a small rust-red barn that backed up to the trees. Their property included no tillable land, and the original owner apparently erected the barn to house a couple of horses and some chickens. Travis and Nora used it as a garage, because the dirt driveway led 200 yards in from the highway, past the house, directly to the double doors in the barn. Travis suspected that when the outsider arrived, it would scout the house from the woods and then from the cover of the barn. It might even wait in there, hoping to catch them by surprise when they came out for the Dodge pickup or the Toyota. Therefore, he had rigged the barn with a few surprises. Their nearest neighbors, whom they'd met only once, were over a quarter mile to the north, out of sight beyond trees and chaparral. The highway, which was closer, was not much traveled at night, when the outsider was most likely to strike. If the confrontation involved a great deal of gunfire, the shots would echo and re-echo through the woods and across the bare hills, so the few people in the area, neighbors or passing motorists, would have trouble determining where the noise originated. He ought to be able to kill the creature and bury it before someone came nosing around. Now, more worried about Nora than about the outsider, Travis climbed the back porch steps, unlocked the 2 deadbolts on the rear door, and went into the house, with Einstein close behind him. The kitchen was large enough to serve also as the dining room, yet it was cozy. Oak walls, a Mexican tile floor, beige tile cabinets, oak cabinets, a hand-textured plaster ceiling, the best appliances. The big plank table with 4 comfortable padded chairs and a stone fireplace helped make this the center of the house. There were 5 other rooms, an enormous living room and a den at the front of the first floor, 3 bedrooms upstairs, plus 1 bath down and 1 up. One of the bedrooms was theirs, and 1 served as Nora's studio, where she had done a little painting since they moved in, and the 3rd was empty, awaiting developments. Travis switched on the kitchen lights. Although the house seemed isolated, they were only 200 yards from the highway, and power poles followed the line of their dirt driveway. "I'm having a beer," Travis said. "You want anything?" Einstein padded to his empty water dish, which was in the corner beside his food dish, and scooted it across the floor to the sink. They had not expected to be able to afford such a house so soon after fleeing Santa Barbara, especially not when, during their first call to Garrison Dilworth, the attorney informed them that Travis's bank accounts had indeed been frozen. They'd been lucky to get the $20,000 check through. Garrison had converted some of both Travis's and Nora's funds into 8 cashier's checks as planned, and had sent them to Travis addressed to Mr. Samuel Spencer Hyatt, the new persona, care of the Marin County Motel, where they had stayed for nearly a week. But also, claiming to have sold Nora's house for a handsome 6-figure price, he had sent another packet of cashier's checks 2 days later to the same motel. Speaking with him from a payphone, Nora had said, "But even if you did sell it, they can't have paid the money and closed the deal so soon." "No," Garrison had admitted. "It won't close for a month, but you need the cash now, so I'm advancing it to you." They had opened 2 accounts and a bank in Carmel, 30-odd miles north of where they now lived. They had bought the new pickup, then had taken Garrison's Mercedes north to the San Francisco airport leaving it there for him. Heading south again, past Carmel and along the coast, they looked for a house in the Big Sur area. When they'd found this one, they'd been able to pay cash for it. It was wiser to buy than rent, and was wiser to pay cash rather than finance the house, for fewer questions needed to be answered. Travis was sure their ID would stand up, but he saw no reason to test the quality of Van Dyne's papers until necessary. Besides, after buying a house, they were more respectable. The purchase added substance to their new identities. While Travis got a bottle of beer from the refrigerator, twisted off the cap, took a long swallow, then filled Einstein's dish with water, the retriever went to the walk-in pantry. The door was ajar, as always, and the dog opened it all the way. He put one paw on a pedal that Travis had rigged for him just inside the pantry door, and the light came on in there. In addition to shelves of canned and bottled goods, the huge pantry contained a complex gadget that Travis and Nora had built to facilitate communication with the dog. The device stood against the rear wall. 28 one-inch square tubes made of lucite, lined up side by side in a wooden frame. Each tube was 18 inches tall, open at the top, and fitted with a pedal release valve at the bottom. In the first 26 tubes were stacked lettered tiles from 6 Scrabble games, so Einstein would have enough letters to be able to form long messages. On the front of each tube was a hand-drawn letter that showed what it contained, A, B, C, D, and so on. The last 2 tubes held blank game tiles, on which Travis had carved commas, or apostrophes, and question marks. They decided they could figure where the periods were supposed to go. Einstein was able to dispense letters from the tubes by stepping on the pedals, then could use his nose to form the tiles into words on the pantry floor. They had chosen to put the device in there, out of sight, so they would not be required to explain it to neighbors who might drop in unexpectedly. As Einstein busily pumped pedals and clicked tiles against one another, Travis carried his beer and the dog's water dish out to the front porch, where they would sit and wait for Nora. By the time he came back, Einstein had finished forming a message. "Could I have some hamburger? Or 3 weenies?" Travis said, "I'm going to have lunch with Nora when she gets home. You want to wait and eat with us?" The retriever licked his chops and thought for a moment. Then he studied the letters he had already used, pushed some of them aside, and reused the rest along with a K and a T and an apostrophe that he had to release from the lucite tubes. "Okay, but I'm starved." "You'll survive," Travis told him. He gathered up the lettered tiles and sorted them into the open tops of the proper tubes. He retrieved the pistol-grip shotgun that he'd stood by the back door and carried it out to the front porch, where he put it beside his rocking chair. He heard Einstein turn off the pantry light and follow him. They sat in anxious silence. Travis in his chair, Einstein on the redwood floor. Songbirds trilled in the mild October air. Travis sipped at his beer, and Einstein lapped occasionally at his water, and they stared down the dirt driveway into the trees toward the highway that they could not see. In the glove compartment of the Toyota, Nora had a .38 pistol loaded with hollow-point cartridges. During the week since they had left Marin County, she had learned to drive, and with Travis's help, had become proficient with the .38, also with a fully automatic Uzi pistol and a shotgun. She only had the .38 today, but she'd be safe going and coming from Carmel. Besides, even if the outsider had crept into the area without Einstein's knowledge, it did not want Nora. It wanted the dog. So she was perfectly safe. But where was she? Travis wished he'd gone with her. But after 30 years of dependency and fear, solo trips into Carmel were out of the means by which she asserted and tested her new strength, independence, and self-confidence. She would not have welcomed his company. By 1:30, when Nora was half an hour late, Travis began to get a sick, twisting feeling in his gut. Einstein began to pace. 5 minutes later, the retriever was the first to hear the car turning into the foot of the driveway at the main road. He dashed down the porch steps, which were at the side of the house, and stood at the edge of the dirt lane. Travis did not want Nora to see that he had been overly worried, because somehow that would seem to indicate a lack of trust in her ability to take care of herself, an ability that she did indeed possess, and that she prized. He remained in his rocking chair, his bottle of Corona in one hand. When the blue Toyota appeared, he sighed with relief. As she went by the house, she tooted the horn.